The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of June 4th, 2018. On this week's show, Ethan Sherwood-Strauss of The Athletic will be here to discuss what might have been in the NBA Finals, because what's actually happening in the series, where the Warriors are now up 2-0 over the Cavs, is way less interesting. We'll also discuss the allegation that Philadelphia 76ers general manager Brian Colangelo, or someone close to him, has been operating a series of anonymous Twitter accounts that have insulted Sixers players, revealed confidential information, and are just generally extremely weird. Finally, ESPN's Greg Wyshynski will join us to gab about the Stanley Cup Final, where as we record on Monday morning, the Washington Capitals have a 2-1 lead over the Vegas Golden Knights. Joining me here in our studio in Washington, D.C. is the author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic, a man who is not rocking the red. It is Washington Capitals hater, Stefan Fatsis. Hello, Stefan.
Not a Washington Capitals hater.
Well, you're not rocking the red.
That makes me a hater?
It does. In this city where everyone is just in love with their caps and is just displaying their affection, the fact that you're not is just an insult to all that the nation's capital stands for.
Fine.
Before we get going today, Stefan, I wanted to put a call out to the listeners. I rarely ask for anything. Sometimes I ask for you to subscribe to Slate Plus, but I rarely ask for anything. And it would be very helpful if folks rated and reviewed the show. We haven't put out a call for that in a while. So if you've been listening, we've been doing the show for like 9 years. If you've been listening for that long or even any fraction of that length, we'd really appreciate it if you bang the 5 stars and write us a nice review on iTunes. It really helps with discovery of the show with folks who haven't heard it. It's one of the main factors that iTunes uses to promote our shows. And so if you're feeling in any way any sort of affection for Stefan Fatsis,
or Josh Levine,
please write a review. It would be really useful, and it would help more folks get to hear our musings. On Sunday night in Oakland, the Golden State Warriors beat the Cleveland Cavaliers 122-103 to go up 2-0 in the NBA Finals. It was an easy win in a series that was supposed to be all about easy wins for the Warriors. Steph Curry scored 33 and set an NBA Finals record with 9 three-pointers. Kevin Durant was good. Klay Thompson was good, etc. But game one of these finals did not go according to that script. So rather than linger on an expected and frankly kind of boring outcome, let's dive back into one of the weirdest games in NBA history, one that ended with what I've taken to calling the brain fart heard around the world. Ethan Sherwood-Strauss of The Athletic joins us now. And my first question for you, Ethan, as someone who's been at Oracle Arena, is do you see a brain fart or do you hear a brain fart?
You know what's so funny? In this case, I mostly heard the brain fart because I was watching the game in the bowels of Oracle Arena. There was some seating snafu, so I was sitting in this media area watching a video feed as opposed to watching the game. And what's so frustrating at Oracle, which in many ways is a charmingly podunk operation, is that they didn't have the live feed. What they had was the Jumbotron feed that you could watch in the media area. The Jumbotron feed would give it to you live, a little bit blurry, one slight catch. At moments of import, a graphic would go up on the screen that would interrupt the feed telling people to make noise. And so at the moment of George Hill shooting the free throw, the make noise graphic flew up on the screen. And so I did not see the brain fart so much as I heard the brain fart. That is true. Until the other feed kicked in, which was about 11 seconds delayed on ABC, then I saw it. Mm. Then I saw the brain fart.
It was really embarrassing when the kiss cam focused on LeBron and J.R. Smith right after that.
That's the worst.
Have you seen the video? You've seen the video, Stefan, that just for whatever reason, it only came out, I think, like Sunday.
Yeah.
Of the feed of the Cavs bench immediately after J.R. Smith didn't know that the Cavs were not, in fact, in the lead and just like dribbled out the clock at the end of regulation of game one. We've all seen the photo of like LeBron gesticulating wildly at JR in the instant classic, what the fuck are you doing face. But then on the bench, you just see LeBron sitting, stewing in silence, Stefan. And then like about a minute in to this video feed, you see LeBron, like somebody tells him or he realizes that the Cavs actually had a timeout and could have called timeout.
That was really weird to me because LeBron James certainly knew that they had a timeout. Didn't he actually try to call a timeout while J.R. Smith was dribbling toward the other basket, like Jim Marshall of the Vikings in like 1970, whatever, running the wrong way with the ball? And two,
that they had a timeout, but then about a minute and he was like, "Oh, we really had a timeout."
And part two of that, Ethan, that struck me as so bizarre, and maybe not, because it was really, I think, it's like a case study of like human emotion, is that there was no effort to recover from what just happened. Nobody was consoling J.R. Smith. LeBron James was not standing up saying, "Hey guys, let's go do it in overtime." Tyronn Lue doesn't even like appear in this shot. Yeah. There's no group huddle. There's no plan. The thing
Tyronn Lue had
for
already
two
actually
and a half.
Started his post-game press conference to complain about them reversing the block charge. He was getting his talking points.
And the video just runs for 2.5 or 3 minutes. And then they get up and you hear the siren go off and the announcer say, "It's overtime."
Yeah, they really should cut that video so that Paul Simon's voice kicks in singing "Hello Darkness, My Old Friend" at that exact moment. Because it really was 1,000-yard stare time as opposed to let's regroup and win this thing time. I had a colleague last night point to it after the game, and you know, maybe this is getting ahead of ourselves, but said this is where the series ended. Right here is where the series ended.
Well, kind of no shit, Ethan's colleague.
Well, I don't know if I buy all that. Not because I'm just jumping ahead and saying probability is inevitability, but because I think that this was more of a hilarious mistake than a meaningful mistake. I think that this was more about the frustrations with JR not being focused on basketball and how I wouldn't say up and down, because that's really just a euphemism for when somebody's been bad. When you say he's been so inconsistent, no, JR Smith's been pretty disappointing this season. And there have been frustrations from what I've heard about his focus. And so that's what this was. But JR Smith is not a good two-point shooter. In fact, he's quite a bad two-point shooter. I think he was 2 of 16 going into this one in the playoffs on two-point shots.
LeBron was wide open.
Here's the thing. You've got to consider the J.R. Smith butterfly effect, which, as I wrote, is oddly not about Smith getting distracted by a monarch. It's he's only in that position because he doesn't know the time and score, where he's running backwards and happens to see LeBron open from three. So I would say that did not swing the game. It's far less meaningful than George Hill missing the free throw. It's just that some mistakes are far more hilarious and memorable than others, and there's really no excuse for what J.R. Smith did. It's total basketball negligence as opposed to missing a free throw, which we can understand just kind of happens.
Well, I think the thing that you're not taking into account there, I agree with what you say. Like, there's certainly no guarantee that the Cavs make a shot there. But you have to think about how the hilarious mistake, or what we might think is hilarious, becomes meaningful if the Cavs think it's meaningful. And clearly, based on the 1,000-yard stare that we've just described, the Cavs thought this was a hugely significant moment, both because of what it meant as far as their chances to win game one, but also maybe what it told them about J.R. Smith. I mean, we can think of 1,000 reasons why, just beyond, you know, what merely happened on the floor, this would have a profound psychological effect on this team and on their chances of winning the series.
I mean, I think as good as and as focused as LeBron James is, and as remarkable a sort of memory and an analytical basketball brain that he has, he ultimately remains a human being. And how can he not be sitting there thinking, I had fucking Kyrie Irving on my team last year.
Or also, I scored 51.
Or also, I scored 51 points.
He didn't have
51 yet.
Yeah.
Right.
But yeah,
he only had a lot.
He only had 49 in regulation. Mm.
I mean, I had Dwayne Wade, who would have probably been helpful in a situation like this on my team. And instead, I'm surrounded by dumbasses like J.R. Smith. I just don't know how he could. Even LeBron James, I don't think, could get it. And I think we saw that in game two. He did not seem to me. I mean, look, you can't score 40, 51 points every night. But yep, there was something sort of that looked materially different to me. And I don't know if I'm just projecting. We're all just projecting because of what happened in game one.
I felt it too, and I haven't gone over the film of it, but I believe LeBron was minus 18 last night, and it was a pretty efficient offensive performance, or a decent offensive performance. But yeah, I wonder how locked in he was defensively, because it seemed like they weren't drawing the massive benefit that they usually do from him being in the game. And I'm not going to reject the Cavs' lived experience. I do think that all of this matters, that it was so particularly frustrating in a unique way that it could be all the more crushing. I think that some of the counterexamples, or some of the pushback to how LeBron might reasonably feel, how you would feel if you were LeBron, is that this is the bed that he made for himself, that the roster looks the way it looks in large part because of the influence that LeBron has had over it.
LeBron had 29 and 13 assists in game two. And I also have not gone back and watched the film. I'm just going to put that out there. But there were a lot of potential assists that were left on the table there. Like, LeBron was getting everyone involved and getting dudes open looks. The Cavs, I think, were 6-for-20 on open threes in game one. I haven't seen the numbers for game two, but LeBron
9-for-26 from three, I think.
For everything that you guys are saying about, like, whether the look in LeBron's gross bloodshot eye was different, or he came out with a different mindset or whatever in game two,
he
definitely put his team in a position, in very good positions, in game two. And defensively, the Cavs just had no chance in game two at all. They might have lost if no matter what, no matter if those open threes were going in, no matter if LeBron had been more aggressive. They just look totally clueless, as many teams do against the Warriors, and against, you know, as the Cavs have looked against, like, pretty much every team in the NBA in the regular season.
Well, they had four players in double figures, the Cavs. It wasn't terrible. They had a lot of assists. They kept it close for three quarters. But Steph Curry...
Well, these were the kind of moral victories we were thinking
the
Cavs were going to get going into
the
series.
Except it was a blowout in the fourth quarter.
Right.
But Steph Curry was remarkable. And the thing to me, Ethan, and you've watched him a lot more than either Josh or I have, the way he gets open is just... it's otherworldly. It's crazy. And how in tune whoever is anticipating where he is going is with his movement is really beautiful to watch.
I think an underrated aspect of his play is just the conditioning. And it's all the more impressive considering that he missed a few months with the MCL injury when JaVale McGee fell on him. But he's come back, and he's still a better conditioned athlete than a lot of the people who are trying to track him. And a lot of it's that he's so feared that you can almost leverage that fear to where everybody is just so adrenaline packed and trying to stop the initial three pointer from Steph, but then they relax. It's almost like they only have that much in them, and then from there, the Warriors manipulate the situation to get him open later in the possession. So you've stopped him now, but now he's going to pop out. So what the Warriors did, and I drew the analogy of almost in the way in 1917, how the British converted a destroyer, a battle cruiser, into an aircraft carrier, you know, a lumbering ship that couldn't sneak up on anybody and attack at the point of attack in the way that they were using a Kevon Looney or Jordan Bell by sticking them at the rim, but instead making them an aircraft carrier, having them far from the fray to help a bomber and help a bomber refuel. And Steph Curry, continue to follow me on the analogy here. So
the best analogies are the longest ones, Ethan.
Steph would throw the ball ahead to Kevon Looney at the three-point line, since nobody was guarding him, everybody would kind of freak out as Steph would then sprint towards Looney and or sprint towards Jordan Bell and hide behind them in the corner. And with a switching defense, it was completely confusing. And so much of the strategy, so much of the art is just taking whatever scheme you might have, whatever cleverness to stop Steph and leveraging it against you. And that was a great example last series. In this series, I think it's more just, you know, like conditioning and back cuts going one way or the other way. But I think it's also similar because Kevin Love is jumping above the three-point line. It's anything but threes. It's Kevin Love's going to switch on Steph Curry, no three-pointer at all, chase him off the line. But then Steph runs past Kevin Love into the meat of the defense, and then he pops out and later in the possession gets open. And that's a lot of what we were seeing.
And that's the most amazing part of it. It's the pops out and gets open, and suddenly he's like behind some 6'9" dude.
The aircraft
in the
carrier.
Corner at the three-point line. It's like, how the fuck did he get there?
Oh, he got there.
He got there.
Yeah. I mean, the Cavs don't really have a winning defensive strategy here. I mean, they did as well as they can in game one, certainly. But in game two, I mean, the Cavs were trying to switch. They were switching pretty much everything. And it ended up with George Hill covering Kevin Durant in the post. Yeah. And Durant is just like turning around and making like a warm-up jumper over him. Like Durant had a really tough time in game one. And I think, you know, based on what we saw in the Rocket series and sort of the 2-year-long history of this team, the way to kind of screw with the Warriors and get in their heads a little bit is to make Durant kind of play outside the Warriors scheme and play more isolation, because it just sort of screws with the Warriors' whole mentality and who they think they are. And the Cavs did that a little bit in game one. And there was all this talk in the Rocket series about Durant's fit on this team and whether they like each other and all that. But in game two, it's just like everybody was happy.
Like they did pretty well.
Everybody was getting what they want. And as I wrote after game two, Durant made everything look so easy. It's just like he could have just scored anytime he wanted. And Steph makes basketball look incredibly hard. And like he is the only one that he can do what he does. And that combination is just like was unstoppable.
And then in the middle there is Klay Thompson, whom you wrote about, Ethan, for The Athletic after game two. Tell us about your piece.
Oh, I just wanted to capture the odd, just myopia, the charming myopia, the strange anti-charisma that is Klay, and tie it together with how he manages to play through pain. And it's almost that I wonder if that productive myopia, as I'll call it, that I love basketball and I'm oblivious to a lot of what else happens in the world. I you know, I'm not too aware of it. I wonder how much of it allows a man to play through pain in a circumstance when others would not. Draymond was saying that he didn't think Klay was going to play. There were a lot of doubts. He was limping. He had a high ankle sprain. That's not an easy injury to play with. I couldn't make sense of some of what's in my article. At one point, I told Klay, giving away my secrets, that I prefer to talk to Zaza about Klay than talk to Klay about Klay. I just think that Klay's a man of few words, and Zaza expounds a bit better. And so here from my article, when informed that Pachulia was speaking for him, Klay said, "That's cool. I don't have much to say." Then a non sequitur, "Especially at the poker table." It was just like, what? Nobody was talking about poker.
I thought we were talking about aircraft carriers. Come on, Klay.
We were. That's completely normal. No, yeah. That's a normal apropos of everything. But the bringing up of poker out of nowhere, there's just this odd focus to it. And it's hard. It's hard when the cliches match up with real life, but I think it does. I think Dan Martinez, who was a Warriors PR guy who now is a Hawks executive, would say to me, notice how on media day, the day where they bring players in for interviews and it's a big circus and October, Klay's the only one who grabs a basketball and starts shooting and dribbling between interviews. He's just completely in love with basketball and won't let anything deter him from that.
Hey guys, I just realized I'm not finished talking about game one.
That's fine. Okay. That's great.
I got like two other things I wanted to say. Stefan, I have something for you about JR, because after the game, he said something, or maybe it was the next day, he said something that was really poignant. He said, "I told somebody right after the game that I'm glad it happened to me as opposed to anybody else on my team. It's not a situation that everybody can handle. We talked after the 2016 finals about how moving it was to see J.R. Smith on the podium crying, talking about how everyone always made fun of him, how he was a champion now. People couldn't take that away from him, how he was so grateful to his parents for standing by him. You know, earlier in this segment, Stefan, you were talking about how J.R. was a dumbass and how you couldn't believe
that. I didn't use that word.
You couldn't believe that LeBron had to deal with somebody like this. And I think I'm not just calling you out. I think everybody has basically been like, poor LeBron. You know, the JR, you know, did this to him. Do you feel like people have gone like way over the top with the JR stuff and it's just like gotten mean?
I think that when an athlete makes a gigantic mistake in a pivotal moment,
then it's
the inevitable. No, I don't think it's okay. Yeah. I think it's the inevitable outcome. I think LeBron is thinking some of those things. I kind of felt badly for J.R. Smith. I didn't take any pleasure in watching him dribble the wrong way.
But none of us certainly expressed that when we were talking about it at the top of the segment.
Because it's such a colossal blunder.
But that means he needs our sympathy more.
Yeah, but we're focused on the blunder first.
Blunder first, sympathy second.
Correct.
That's what we stand for in this podcast. But like, if I mean, maybe this is the place in the media that Ethan Sherwood Strauss needs to be, because especially if you don't think it was that big a deal in terms of the game, Ethan, then
I don't.
You must think that JR is getting way more shit than he deserves.
Yes and no, because it's to me, it's less about whether it mattered and more about what it communicates about one's level of focus and professionalism in that moment. I think that's what provokes the reaction. Now, the internet has a proportionality problem. We don't give you if you deserve, I suppose, a wheelbarrow of shit. We don't give you a wheelbarrow of shit. Mm-hmm. We give you an avalanche, an aircraft carrier of shit flying from the heavens. Death from above via shit is what J.R. Smith is getting. So it's hard to parse. I think that he deserves a wheelbarrow of shit, but there's a diffusion of responsibility. And so everybody is, or maybe even the opposite, everybody's stepping up to the plate to heap scorn upon him.
Well, it was really funny. And like, who is any of us to say that, you know, the 5 millionth person in should stop and the first 4,999,999 already had their swings.
In the future, we will regulate society better. But I maintain, I don't think it had a huge swing in terms of the material difference. I think that if you play that out and if JR knows, he snatches the rebound, good for him, and then he tries to force up a shot. He doesn't run backwards and happen to see LeBron. I don't think that would have been his plan. And he misses the shot and it goes on to overtime and maybe it's different. Maybe the Cavs' souls aren't crushed by
it's
just
materially different even if he just catches and jumps and tries to get it up and Durant swats it into the ninth row.
Look. I won't deny that it gives you a better chance than doing nothing.
I just thought that quote was really poignant. The fact that he would say, "I'm glad it didn't happen to anyone else." That just made me stop for a second.
He also said, "It's a lot of pressure depending on how you look at it, but I tell him all the time, LeBron, he has an opportunity to play with me as well."
Oh,
that was great. And he also lied in the immediate aftermath,
correct,
saying that he knew what was going on. Poor JR. All right.
Wait a second. The man lies and you're saying poor JR? What is this swing? Now I'm becoming more of a condemner.
We're done with JR.
Oh, Josh is trying to dodge the fact that he's like total good humor man here. Come on.
He suffered enough.
He deserved to suffer some.
He suffered enough. All right. I also think we need to take like 2 minutes and then I promise we'll be done to talk about the reversal of the block charge, because there's like a really interesting philosophical question here, Ethan, and you wrote about this in your game story. The review of that play was triggered and can only be triggered by NBA rule if there is a question about whether the defensive player is in the restricted area, in that little circle by the basket. In real time, there was absolutely no question that LeBron was outside the restricted area.
No,
absolutely no question.
There is question. There was question.
I can test that as well.
But there is question. There was question in the minds of the referees who were looking at the play in real time. They said that we were not 100% sure that LeBron was outside the restricted area.
Were they like 92% sure? How sure were they?
Well, they were unsure enough that they decided to review it, which was the right thing to do. Correct, Ethan?
I would say yes. And it's so funny to me. So I was watching the live feed of what was happening, but I'm not on Twitter so much during the game, and I tend to find out what was controversial in retrospect. With JR, it was obvious, but I don't have the advantage, or I would say disadvantage, of hearing the announcers really frame the outrage of the populace. And so to me, when I saw that happen, I thought, oh, okay, so that's what triggered the review. And I don't know if I knew about the exact mechanism for how it gets changed, but yeah, that was the right call. Like, seeing the replay, that's an obvious block. Okay, so they reversed it to an obvious block. Oh man, I guess the Warriors caught a break that they could review that. I didn't have a sense that it was in any way controversial,
dude,
at the moment.
Dude, my dude, come on. I mean, I didn't know that was the rule. I had no idea that you could review whether someone was in the restricted area. And then only if you have that review, you can then decide if it was a block or a charge. That is a weird rule, and it's the only rule like that in the rule book. And again, it's one that I didn't know existed. And based on what I've heard subsequently, like, very few people knew that, and it's very, very rarely invoked.
Clay claimed to me that he knew it, and Zaza said that he's completely lying. And I guess that's just
Clay spokesman.
Does Clay also lie at the poker table? That's what all of our listeners are wondering right now. But
no, but as I don't, just for Clay. Sorry, you.
I was saying,
you were saying,
don't blame Jeff Van Gundy and Mark Jackson for people getting up in arms about this.
Stop,
I mean, that's ridiculous.
Stop complaining. My God, when I watch one of these games after the fact, I don't understand just the utter officiousness, the strange just hall monitor perspective on the game of basketball, as opposed to expressing a love for the sport. And I don't buy that it's just something that comes with being a coach. Hubie Brown can call a game with enthusiasm. I'm completely confused. I'm all for honesty, but I don't understand why the NBA would want its product commentated on to over 20 million people by somebody who's constantly trying to tell the people that the refs are screwing up or some grave injustice is happening. It doesn't seem good for the sport. And in that case, it's hard for me to really suss out. Maybe somebody will say, oh, you're a Warriors homer. I can insist that I do not care. I can tell you I do not care. But if the argument is that they reverse the call and replay review to the correct call by a process that I don't like, that seems to me to be rather flimsy and might speak to you just wanting a different outcome. Not you personally, Josh. I'm not saying that you're
flimsy.
I'm not saying that you're a crypto Cavs fan, but I'm saying that it speaks to some emotionality of wanting a different outcome, I suppose, if you're angry that a call was reversed to the correct call.
I'm not crypto, man. I'm rooting for the Cavs. But
that's fine. It's a much better series of the Cavs win.
I will say this. It's a rule that does not make sense. If you're not going to review any other subjective foul calls, then why are you going to review this particular one? And I am on the record as being opposed to replay creep.
Me too.
And this is an example where if the call had gone the other way and it had been called a block on LeBron on the floor and they hadn't instituted a replay, I would have been totally on board and said, even though I want the Cavs to win, and said, people who are complaining about this are complaining about something that's not super significant. There are other plays in the game that mattered just as much. The process that they went through is fine. These are judgment calls. How could they have possibly seen it in the moment? I would have been way, 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 way happier with that than with what transpired. What transpired was bad, and it's bad for, I think it's worse for the NBA than your complaint about like Jeff Van Gundy saying foul calls are bad.
I think that is minimizing the entire scope of the strange anti-propaganda campaign that Jeff Van Gundy is waging, and really Mark Jackson too is getting in on it as well. Look, let us stop arguing about this. Let us be brothers in arms, because I completely agree with you. Let's bring it back to the 90s. Replay review is stupid. It sucks. It's the object lesson in this case that perfect is the enemy of good. It does not assuage anybody's
feelings. Amen, brother.
It makes people far angrier than they would have been without it. I remember back in the day in the 90s, we didn't have replay review. Sometimes refs screwed up big calls. They did, and people got mad. And you know what happened? We all lived. It was okay. We understood that there's human error involved at some level.
Stefan looks upset.
I think replay review almost communicates to people that there shouldn't be human error, and then you get angry, you get entitled, you get millennial about these outcomes.
Are you getting millennial, Stefan?
I'm just imagining like a 79-74 NBA Finals game from the 90s. That's what I'm imagining right now. I don't want to go back to that.
Guess what, ladies and gentlemen? Life is full of Tony Brothers, and you're just going to have to deal with it. You can't expect this retroactive reality policing to save you. And I would add, and this is a little bit different, what I also don't like about replay review is it robs people of the moment. I don't enjoy how a crowd might be in full throat about how something just happened, and then they go back to the monitor and they say, oh, that thing that you were cheering about when you forgot all of your problems and you just became one as a crowd, actually it didn't happen, and we're now reversing it. So next time that happens, please cheer with just a little bit of doubt in your mind. That's what we would prefer. We want you to have a little bit of doubt that we're going to go back in time and take the thing away.
I'm not defending replay review here. I will defend Jeff Van Gundy a little bit, because in a lot of cases, yeah, he's kind of a killjoy, but he's also right about the NBA's need to address problem rules. Maybe this is a problem rule.
He's totally right about fouls on the fast break. He should keep talking about
that. He's also right about James Harden and LeBron James and everybody else dipping a shoulder into a defender who is vertical and drawing a bullshit shooting foul.
Agreed.
So let him harp on all of that. I find him entertaining, and I still, because I can also juxtapose the image of Jeff Van Gundy complaining about fouls in the NBA with the image of Jeff Van Gundy with his arms wrapped around Alonzo Mourning's legs. Sure. So that tends to calm me down and bring me to a good place.
I now blame you as the person in the focus group who has cursed us with this instant, this constant ref haranguing from Jeff Van Gundy. But I do agree with Jeff Van Gundy on the idea that the Euro foul needs to go. That's a true observation. I agree with all that. So look, there just needs to be, I guess they're trying to find a balance wrong, because they have Jeff Van Gundy constantly making everybody doubt everything about the NBA worse than Donaghy ever did. And then they throw in
They throw in
Steve Jabby as the NBA's Pravda, who will never disagree with a call, and they bring him in to be the what's the NFL guy who
Mike Pereira.
They make him the Pereira, but Pereira will say, oh, this is right or this is wrong. Jabby, in that case, I think framed the controversy because it was an obvious block call, and he was not admitting to that. So he's got to protect his fellow colleagues, protect the shield. So you've got – maybe that's the balance. Maybe that's what the NBA is up to, or what ESPN is up to. Have one guy killing the NBA and one guy who will never admit it. And in the end, it's balanced for the customer.
You want to fix it? Put Doris Burke in the booth.
We're done.
Amen.
We're done. We're done with this.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Before we get to Brian Colangelo and the burner accounts, and that's going to be a good one, a heads up that in our bonus segment for Slate Plus today, we're going to be joined by our colleague Christina Cotarucci to discuss how youth sports instigated her first feminist protest when she was one of the only girls on a co-ed youth soccer team. If you want to hear that conversation, join Slate Plus for just $35 a year. You can sign up at slate.com/hangupplus. Ethan Strauss, we couldn't get rid of you for this segment. You're still here. I want to go a little bit insidery for people, just a little bit behind the scenes action. I emailed you, I think it was on Wednesday, before the NBA Finals had started.
What time?
And it was 4:11 and 10 seconds. And I asked you, what are people talking about? Is there any interest in the NBA Finals, or is it all Brian Colangelo's burner accounts? And what did you say?
I said something to the basically it's all burner accounts. Nobody gives a shit about the finals. It's all burner accounts. This completely taps in to human interest in a way that the NBA Finals does not.
Well, and this was obviously before the intrigue of game one, but everyone in the media, this was all anyone cared about, just the kind of gossip angle of it. And players too, like LeBron made a joke about, you know, somebody was asking him about Dan Gilbert's tweets, and he was like, he tweeted it from his own account, right? Like everyone in the league was totally obsessed with this story, and for good reason. Stefan, what are your thoughts on Brian Colangelo and the Colangelo-related burner phenomenon?
You didn't even get to the part, Josh, where reporters confirmed or at least found evidence that the three mystery accounts that Colangelo had denied being connected with in any way were apparently associated with his wife's cell phone number, the last two digits, 9-1 being his wife's cell phone number. Does it really matter at this point, though? I mean, the evidence is so overwhelming that the content of all of these accounts relate to Colangelo and his interests, whether it's the Sixers or his son's basketball team at the University of Chicago.
Some of the accounts were following the University of Chicago basketball team.
And there were overlapped followers in all of these accounts. I mean, this is just the evidence is overwhelming. Like, it's just the appearance of conflict or the appearance of a connection to this, it precludes Brian Colangelo continuing as the general manager of the Philadelphia 76ers. I mean, what agent, what player is going to trust this guy going forward? I just can't see how it's possible.
I mean, is that really crucial? I know we often say who's going to play for whoever, but we were just talking for a long segment about LeBron James. I mean, we all said he's never going to go back to Cleveland ever again after what Dan Gilbert did. And lo and behold, look what happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, teams and players are fascinated with what the Sixers have. I've been in the locker room after a game where the Warriors played the Sixers, and they're all asking, how many draft picks do they have? Okay. What's their future situation? That's ultimately what matters. I know that there isn't a lot of faith in Colangelo, and people are disgusted. I know players who are disgusted by the idea of lashing out at these really young players and hurting their reputation. So it's a real thing, but I don't think that the Sixers, if they had him at the helm, would just not be able to continue.
I don't know. I don't know. As an organization, can you imagine entrusting player personnel and contract decisions to a guy who behind everyone's back might be trashing other players?
Well, in this case, he happens to be your son if you run the organization. So I think maybe you throw it all out the window. That's another subplot, is that the NBA is quite nepotistic, and that accounts for a lot of inefficiency and accounts for a lot of screw up. So, look, I don't think it's optimal, but I do think that perhaps, and who knows who has influence over what and who has sway over what, that this could be a pretext as much as anything else. What if, and I'm just throwing it out there hypothetically, not saying that I hear such a thing will happen, what if David Griffin, former Cavs GM, wants the Sixers job? And what if you have it on good authority that LeBron James will come to the 76ers because David Griffin's going to be the GM there? That, to me, matters so much more than the specifics of what's going on with Colangelo and the burner accounts. And maybe the burner accounts are just a lovely pretext for getting him out of there so you can get LeBron James on the team.
I was once like you, Ethan, where I thought that this was enough in a gray area, where I thought, like, if you want to fire Colangelo, certainly more than enough reason to fire him. But if you wanted to keep him, you know, especially since it's looking like, you know, it was probably his wife, or a lot of it was his wife.
Well, wait. Like, it was his wife? Maybe he was just using his wife's phone number. I mean, we don't know whether his wife uses this phone. We don't know what phones these are exactly.
I strongly believe.
These are rich people that probably have multiple cell phones.
I strongly believe at this point that Colangelo was not responsible for the tweets, at least the majority of the tweets directly. I don't believe that he did it. I didn't believe that he did it from the moment that I read the Ringer story.
Why?
Which I can get to in a second. But just back to my original point, I thought that it was a gray area, and that this was more than enough to fire him if you wanted to, and that it was, if it comes out that he didn't actually, you know, type the tweets himself, that you could keep the guy. I have since changed my mind and decided that they need to fire this dude right away, no matter what, because I think it's less about the tweets qua tweets and more that this reveals that he is a total asshole and that he is someone who cannot be trusted. He's somebody who is remarkably petty and doesn't seem interested in the parts of his job that one should be interested in.
The serious parts.
He's all just interested in, like, settling scores and, you know, maintaining his reputation. I would, if I saw this stuff, just even if it was based on information that he gave to a family member that just, like, evinces his beliefs, I wouldn't want this guy representing my organization, even on the off chance that, you know, let's say Joel Embiid says, oh, I forgive and forget. Let's say LeBron James says, oh, it doesn't affect my free agency. If there's, like, a 2% chance that that's not right, like, why is this guy doesn't seem that great at his job? Just replace him. Like, what's the loss?
Yeah, it's funny. I thought this initially was 12 Angry Men, where you were going to defend Colangelo, but now you've completely turned and want him out of there. And like I said, I can't argue against that. I think that probably the best call would be to move on. I would just also say that in the NBA, people can persist in situations that are suboptimal. And yeah, it would be uncomfortable with him remaining at the helm and perhaps not the best option. But the Sixers would ultimately muddle through if it happened. And I do think in NBA culture, the operating assumption is that your family member reveals confidential information. I know Amin Al-Hassan has talked about this, ESPN's Amin Al-Hassan, about somebody with the Suns whose son revealed sensitive information, and everybody felt badly, but ultimately the mother had to be fired, and that's just how it goes. So I think the rule is, even if your family member puts it out there and it's not your fault, it is your fault. You just can't let that happen. And I do think that's the rule.
This man is supposed to be in charge of this organization and maintaining some sort of level of sophistication and maturity and protecting confidential information and confidential thoughts and ideas about player personnel, about the future of the franchise, about strategy, about developments, about performance. And those were all violated. And whether Brian Colangelo's fingers were on his phone typing those tweets, to me, is irrelevant, because clearly it was somebody very close who had, as you said, Joss, access to the general manager's thoughts and ideas that revealed them publicly, whether it was him or his son or his family or his wife or his father, who has denied being involved in this in any way, Jerry Colangelo.
We don't know. Well, we should be clear at this point. Well,
We don't know who did this.
Yeah.
But the bigger irony here is that the Colangelo family, and Jerry Colangelo, owner of the Phoenix Suns, head of USA Basketball, has been in the NBA for decades.
Highly respected.
Right. These guys were brought in because Sam Hinkie was the problem, right?
He was bringing disrepute to the organization. All right, just to close that loop, and then I'm going to get into my thoughts on the journalism that was done here. I think the bigger issue here is the way that sharing the confidential information is bad. The way that it was deployed, which is to win arguments online with Twitter eggs and to make Brian Colangelo look good and his predecessors and successors look bad. It was all about Colangelo reputation management online. It had nothing to do with anything that should matter to an NBA team.
With
it was
like
this, 200 this guy,
people.
This guy is just online. All out. This guy is just like all out for himself and making himself look good and, you know, making sure people know that his collars are awesome on his shirts.
Well, yeah.
But
got some good shirts.
Let me talk about the Ringer story for a second because I'm curious what you guys think. It was obviously a fantastic scoop. It was a story that everyone in the entire NBA was like talking about instantly, and it like changed the course of the league potentially. It's a huge story and a huge coup for them. I was not that. I don't think they nailed the story, and I was like slightly disappointed by that because I feel like if there had been like a couple extra steps taken, it could have been totally nailed down. But at the point that the story came out, the Ringer just, you know, they had some caveats in there. This may or may not be Brian Colangelo. But, you know, Ben Dietrich quotes his source, an anonymous source who Ben Dietrich still doesn't know who it is, saying, to me, there is no conceivable world where this is not Brian Colangelo himself, not his wife, not his son, not his dad. And Ben Dietrich just basically allows his source to say that. He doesn't explain it. He doesn't say, this is the evidence that I have that's like 100% why it can't be his wife or his son or his dad. He just basically lets the source stipulate that. And I just had a hard time, you know, reading the story, understanding why that would be the case. Like, you know, we know that Roger Goodell's wife defended him online with anonymous accounts. We know that Kevin Durant defended himself personally online with burner accounts. We've seen, you know, it go both ways, but there just wasn't any, you know, ironclad proof at that point for them to justify coming out as hard as they did, even with those caveats saying, well, this was Brian Colangelo.
You're kind of right, but I don't think maybe doing that would have made the story more airtight journalistically, but I think it would have not been as big a story because there's almost an irony here or a paradox where journalism is about uncovering secrets, but people love a little mystery. Mystery is part of the sauce that made this. No, the what's going on here? Who is it exactly? Is it him? Is Serial as good if we just have definitive proof that Adnan did it? I don't think so.
They didn't press on it, Ethan. They didn't. There's stuff that they could have done. They weren't the ones who found that, you know.
I'm not saying you're wrong, and I'm not saying this is an intentional byproduct. I'm just saying that there is something to this idea that it was a little bit up in the air, that we could all speculate, that Reddit could get on the case and try to investigate it further. The way that it was done without every loose end being tied together, I think made the story, it amplified it and made it a bigger story. That's all I'm noting.
If I were editing the story, I would have taken that quote out. The no conceivable world where this is not Brian Colangelo. I think if you take that quotation out, there were enough caveats and enough rigorous explanation of how the Ringer and Ben Dietrich got to this point, comparing followers, examining individual tweets, examining which accounts only followed and didn't tweet at all. It was pretty rigorous in terms of, it was pretty thorough in analyzing the way these accounts are connected.
It was. It was like a last mile problem. I mean, they got 95% of the way there, which is why I was a little bit disappointed. And I don't mean to like lecture or harangue, but I think it's important, you know, for me to remind myself and for everyone who does this kind of work that you need to question things that you want to be true and think of alternative hypotheses, because it's a better story if this is Brian Colangelo doing it himself. It certainly seemed like it was Brian Colangelo doing it himself. There's a lot of you can certainly put all of the, like, you know, push pens and string on the string board together in a way that it looks very clear that it's Brian Colangelo doing this. But I just didn't get the sense from the story, especially because of the inclusion of that quote, which wasn't challenged, that they had considered the alternate theories. And I think if they had gone down that pathway, it would have been a better reported story, a deeper story, and one where they could have maybe gotten the answer. Rather than having the Sixers do this investigation, maybe they wouldn't have gotten it, but it seems possible to me.
Would you have liked if before the story was completed, Dietrich had done almost a TMZ and showed up to the Wells Fargo Center and with a camera, just sort of, I wouldn't say accost, that sounds aggressive, but just went up to Colangelo and started pelleting him with these direct questions. Do you think that would have been a good methodology? I kind of think so. I would have loved to have seen that before. Now you're not going to be able to get at him, but before shit hit the fan, maybe that would have been the way to put.
So you mean instead of going to the Sixers PR department?
No. You went to the Sixers PR department. You did all that. Now show up to the premises, and maybe the way this broke, maybe the Sixers season was already over, and it wouldn't be so easy to catch him. But I just wonder if that would have been the way to do it. Just walk up to him, metaphorically grab him by that oversized collar, and just ask away. I wonder if that would have clarified anything.
That might have been entertaining. I don't think it would have done what I am looking to do here. There was just
no,
immediately
it,
after
it,
this...
that's why we're talking past each other.
Yeah.
You're talking about the responsibilities, the holy responsibilities of the Fourth Estate and what is prudent journalism. And I'm just saying, how do we make this circus even more snazzy? How do we entertain the people?
That's why we go so well together. That's why.
Yes. I mean, I have to say,
it's a regular Van Gundy and Javi. But yeah, you were saying
the approach was good journalistically. I think they were very smart to give them the two accounts to see how they would respond to the other three accounts. So they tell them about the two accounts, and the Sixers or somebody shuts down, or mysteriously the other three accounts get shut down. That was really smart, and that does go some distance toward proving some connection among these accounts.
Yeah, I think I said that.
It doesn't prove anything. You're right.
It was a great, great story, and I think they just kind of did not stick the landing.
Right.
What you wanted was
more reporting to have been done, more sourcing to get to someone whom you can trust, who is not anonymous the way the tipster is anonymous in the story, to say, yeah, I know that was Colangelo.
It just feels to me like there was a little bit more sleuthing that could have been done, and as a reader, it felt like they thought that they had cracked it, and thus there wasn't any need to press on it anymore. They didn't need to, you know, see what the recovery phone number on the account was. They, you know, other people found connections to folks on the follower list that worked with Brian Colangelo's wife, and maybe that would have pointed them in that direction. It just felt like, again, as a reader, I don't have any inside information, that it just looked like they thought the story was done. And that's my thought.
And I counter that there just wasn't enough reckless speculation. Just to entertain me. Not enough asides about high society Toronto, which is just a strata that I don't think I've thought about. But, you know, you have your perspective, more responsible journalism, getting the facts straight. I have my perspective, more accusations, more blood in the water. And we come to an agreement at some point. It works.
Ethan Strauss works for The Athletic, and you should totally subscribe to The Athletic if you believe in the journalistic values that Ethan has espoused throughout this podcast. Ethan, it's always great to have you on. Thank you so much for taking the time.
It's always a pleasure. You guys, thanks so much for having me.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City Branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
The pregame ceremonies for the Vegas Golden Knights have been elaborately choreographed productions featuring sword fights and lasers and digital cannonballs and Michael Buffer and Imagine Dragons. Here's how it went down at the home of the Washington Capitals before Game 3 of the Stanley Cup Finals on Saturday night.
And now, here to announce tonight's starting lineups, please welcome longtime Caps season ticket holder, Pat Sajak.
Thank you. Thank you, Wes. You're the best. Thank you. excited as I am?
the famed catchphrase, are you as excited as Pat Sajak?
Yes. The Caps were excited, though. They beat Vegas 3-1. They lead the series 2-1. Game 4 is on Monday night in D.C. after the taping of this podcast. Greg Wyshynski of ESPN is on the line with us now. He's at morning skate at the Kettler Ice Arena in Virginia. Hey, Greg.
I very much am looking forward to the scintillating intro to Game 4, in which I imagine Wink Martindale will be reading out the lineups for both teams. Through a seance? I don't know if he's still around or not. But game show hosts are obviously the best response to Vegas-style pyrotechnics, aren't they?
He's still alive. Wink Martindale. He's, I think he's probably a Nashville Predators fan.
Oh, really?
Given that he's from Jackson, Tennessee. Hmm. But who knows? You know, the NHL playoffs are all about surprises, Greg.
They certainly are. And what a surprise to have a Pat Sajak in a Capitals pullover reading out the starting lineups. They had a week to plan for this. You know, it's like, and the best thing I read the entire night to encapsulate the difference between the Vegas opening and the Washington opening by far was Pat Sajak equals Reno.
That's good. I like that.
That is good.
The biggest little game show host in the world.
All right. The Capitals have the best player left, Alex Ovechkin. They have the momentum after that game three. They were pretty dominant in game three. And they've got the better storyline, years of failure, blah, blah, blah. I love the term morning skate, Greg. There's something earnestly hockey about morning skate. What is your view from morning skate?
Enthusiasm, I would say. You know, the thing about this Capitals team, and I'll give you some pushback on them being the better story because a team created out of whole cloth in the last year trying to win a Stanley Cup for a city that's used it to heal itself after a massive tragedy is a pretty good story, too.
Yeah, but it's the expansion thing is just preposterous.
Okay, well, fair enough. There is that caveat. The thing about the Capitals that I find really interesting can be boiled down to one play in game three, which is when Braden Holtby, their goaltender, turned the puck over to Thomas Nosek, a fourth line player for the Golden Knights. He scores, he cuts the Capitals lead. And in years past, the entire bench would have gone to the sunken place for the Capitals. They would have wilted, they would have folded, doubt would have crept through the arena, an impending sense of doom would have permeated from the stands. But instead, they kept playing. It didn't even faze them. This moment that would have been a pivot to bad things in every other playoff I've ever covered for this team, they just brushed their shoulder off of it. And I think that is the exact attitude that they've had throughout these playoffs. Go down two games to the Columbus Blue Jackets, come roaring back to win that series. Play your arch nemesis, Pittsburgh. You've only beaten once in franchise history, and you beat them. They faced all sorts of adversity. They're a completely different team psychologically than I've ever seen, and that's why they're here.
I wanted to talk about Braden Holtby's save from game two, which has already been immortalized in flip book form. I was just watching that this morning. It was the standout play of the playoffs this far. Some people are calling it the greatest save ever. It's certainly saved the game for the Capitals in game two, prevented it from going into overtime where they could have gone down to nothing in the series. Can you walk us through what happened in that save and also just given your years of experience watching goaltending, where did it rank for you?
Well, so the puck kind of took a weird bounce in the Vegas attacking zone and kind of went from one side of the rink to the other, where it was collected by a Vegas player who then sent it back the other way to Alex Tuch. Now, Alex Tuch is a pretty decent goal scorer, big-bodied power forward, came over from the Minnesota Wild. I was at the game, and the only way I could describe it is the net looked empty. I mean, it was as gaping a wide-open net as you could imagine, and it was as if he had a layup. It's the only way you could describe it. Suddenly, Holtby lurches back to his right with his stick and manages to block the shot. Now, in that moment, and in hindsight, you say to yourself, well, why didn't Alex Tuch elevate the puck? Because if that puck is a few inches off the ice, that's a goal. And the thing is that it's such a bang-bang play. You're just looking to get it into the net as quickly as possible before the goaltender can do anything about it. So I talked to Tuck after that and asked him, you know, how it felt to be Ralph Branca to Bobby Thompson, basically. And he said, hey, you know, it's one game. It's a hockey play and a game full of hockey plays, and you just have to move on. But, I mean, he's been immortalized in one of the biggest and most clutch and emphatic saves in Stanley Cup final history. The fact that it happened in game two probably doesn't mean it's going to mean as much. It'll be a footnote to history rather than being the definitive play in the series. But it still was one of the most incredible saves that I've ever witnessed in person.
Stefan, the thing that was really notable for me is that it was just kind of a great reminder of like how we use visual cues, especially in hockey, and maybe it's just because I'm more of an inexperienced hockey watcher, to kind of tell what's happening on the ice, because all of the cues were there that said goal. It was guy in front of the net, it was empty net, and it was fans in Vegas celebrating because right. they saw all the same things
right.
that I saw. It was a goal. Everything about it said goal.
And we should mention also that it would have tied the game at that point too. So, I mean, yeah. Everything was on the line on that shot, and Holtby stopped it. And it was remarkable to see.
It also demonstrates the outrageous flexibility and mobility that National Hockey League goaltenders possess. And also the total serendipity that so often turns hockey games, especially playoff hockey games. I mean, you know, a quarter of an inch up or down with the random throw of his stick across the goal mouth, and the puck ricochets and deflects into the net.
Yeah, and the randomness extends beyond that one play, too. I mean, Braden Holtby didn't start the first two games of these playoffs. He had a lackluster finish to the regular season. Philip Grubauer, his backup goalie, was given the starts in games one and two of the first round against Columbus. Holtby came back in game two and has started every game since and has progressively gotten better as the playoffs have gone on. He's one of only five goalies in NHL history to pitch shutouts in games six and seven of a series to close out the Tampa Bay Lightning. And he's continued this play on into the Stanley Cup final outside of an anomaly that was game one, where both teams just were super amped up and put 10 goals on the board.
Right. The other play that I want to point to happened in game three, and it was the first goal by Alex Ovechkin. He was not in his customary spot out on the left circle or at the point on a power play. He was mucking it up in the crease.
And
he, I mean, it was an amazing, amazing play. I mean, he was on his backhand, diving, tripping over somebody and flicking the puck up over the Marc-Andre Fleury and into the net. It was a terrific play, and I thought it epitomized how Ovechkin has been playing. This dude is motivated to win the Stanley Cup.
The thing about Ovi that's interesting, we actually have a roundtable on this on ESPN.com about whether there's been a material change in the way he's played or whether it's just the perception of people who never gave him the proper credit as a postseason performer finally coming around to the idea that he is this good. I'm kind of in the middle of those. I think that he has always been a playoff performer, but has never been given the credit for it. His stats have always been sterling. The effort's always been there. Has he played with a bit more vim and vigor this postseason? For sure. He is right now at his highest points per game average since 2010. So things are going really well. The difference for me with Ovechkin is the fact that the things that he's doing are coming at very important, impactful times.
Right.
Like he had a hand in three game winning goals against the Penguins, so the Capitals finally get past them. He scored two back-breaking goals in games one and two on the road, wins at Tampa. He scored the first goal in game seven against the Lightning, and statistically that basically handed the game to the Capitals. And then, of course, in game three here in Washington, it's as Barry Trotz, his coach, mentioned, it's only appropriate that Alex Ovechkin scores the first goal in the first Stanley Cup final game in Washington in 20 years. So it's not necessarily that he's done remarkably different things as far as the mechanics of his game, but for whatever reason, the timeliness of his contributions has been much more evident and much more important this time around than in previous postseasons.
I'm going to muck it up in the crease a little bit here with my next point. I think there's a connection sort of back to the Holtby save. And you mentioned, Greg, about just how just very small things can make dramatic turns in the NHL playoffs. And I connect that to the response that we've seen here in DC, where people are just going bananas for this team. And I think that there's a connection there between hockey being a kind of resolutely local sport and these sort of magical runs that you see in the NHL playoffs. You know, we talked about how in game one of the NBA finals, it was like totally unpredictable. And there's a connection that can be made there about a couple of things that could have gone differently. And that game could have gone a different way.
Really? It could have, maybe.
But generally in the NBA, the things that you expect to happen end up happening. And in the NHL, it's just totally different. And the fact that you're on kind of like a journey with your team and the fact that they make it to the Stanley Cup final, it just feels like magical realism in some way. And I think that's especially the case in DC because of what we already talked about and how this team just always managed to pull defeat from the jaws of victory. And I think just what we've seen like on the street outside the arena after game three, it feels like it's all connected to me.
Right. And it goes beyond that, too. I mean, most Washington Capitals fans are also Redskins fans, are also Nationals fans. You know, I'm sure there's a crossover with the Wizards as well. And the totality of the sports scene here in D.C., I mean, they've been the losingest city, I think, overall since the early 1990s for cities that have the four major sports. There's just not been anything to really kind of hang your hat on. Even the time the Caps made the Cup final, they got swept by the Detroit Red Wings. So there's this sort of catharsis happening for the DC sports fan through the Washington Capitals run in this playoff. And, you know, like you said, I mean, it is the only way you can really understand it is Brian McClellan, the general manager of the Washington Capitals, walked into game seven against the Pittsburgh Penguins last postseason, a game that the Capitals ended up losing. And he felt like, you know, it was going to be a bad night. He felt the negativity in the building even before the game started, because there was this notion, not only from the fans in the stands, but also from the bench, that they were already defeated. And to have this moment where they finally get past Pittsburgh, they're unburdened by that, and now they're back in the Cup final, and they're there for the first time in the tenure of Alex Ovechkin and Nicholas Backstrom and John Carlson, Yevgeny Kuznetsov, all these players that have become beloved figures for this fan base, there is a sense of celebration just in the sense that they're here, but now that they can taste it, you know, they don't want anything else but to seal the deal. And we mentioned Ovechkin before, and like, it does come back to him ultimately, the idea that we could be watching what might end up being the best goal scorer in the history of the National Hockey League. There's a chance he could catch Gretzky. But could really? You? Oh, yeah. If you look at his durability in games played, and you look at his offensive output, and you kind of game it out for how many years he might still have left in him and his productivity, statistically, there's a chance he could catch Gretzky. Statistically, there's a very good chance he's going to finish as the second leading goal scorer in NHL history. But there's an outside chance he can catch Wayne, which is incredible. But if he ever did that, you know, no matter where he ends up being in the totality of goal scoring greatness in the NHL, the last thing you ever want is for him to go into the Hall of Fame and have some Canadian writer being like, yeah, but where's his ring? Yeah, it's the last thing any hockey fan wants, right? So there's been this sort of movement afoot through the years, and very much recently, where hockey fans just want to see Ovechkin win. They want to see him raise the cup. They've seen his peers do it. They don't want that caveat to exist where he is, you know, Dan Marino or somebody like that. They want him to have the glory and the stats to go along with it.
Everyone is so nice in hockey. You know, everyone, they want Ovechkin to succeed. It's very sweet.
Oh, no, but you see, they're not, though, because he had to be tortured for the better part of a dozen years. I mean, you know, you had to have people calling him. You know, there was one guy who wrote for the Hockey News that said the Capitals should let him go to the KHL in Russia because his time here was done. Like, there's no question that Ovechkin has been put through the ringer to get to this point. But like,
they should have left him open on the expansion draft. Let him go to Vegas.
Precisely. Yeah, with his old GM there. But that's the thing. Like, you know, you go through that process and you you're tortured. You see the Penguins beat you three times and win the cup each time. And, you know, Sidney Crosby, the guy that who's been your arch rival throughout your career, doing it, you know, three times to you. You go through that and to get to this moment where then it becomes, you know, all the more incredible and all the more vital and all the more joyous if the Capitals actually pull this thing off.
The one sour note on the Capitals to me has been the play of Tom Wilson. He was suspended for three games during the Penguins series for an illegal hit to the head. He's been involved in a lot of nasty hits. And yeah, there's nasty hitting in hockey, but his play and the lack of attention to the NHL's concussion protocol seems to be a real problem in this league. Brooks Orpik took a huge hit in game three, came right back into the game on his next shift without, it appeared, being assessed in any meaningful way. And up in Canada, Rick Westhead, journalist, has gotten a hold of testimony from NHL executives in a lawsuit filed by former players about concussions and CTE, in which the commissioner of the National Hockey League, Gary Bettman, and his subordinates and team owners display a remarkable and implausible level of deniability about the existence of CTE, not to mention the connection between getting hit in the head a lot and developing CTE, which many former NHL players have, in fact, done.
The Wilson stuff is divisive, to be sure, in the sense that, you know, the every time now that he has a hit that's borderline, and the hit that he put on Jonathan Marchessault earlier in this postseason shouldn't have been a suspension and wasn't. But every time he lays out somebody now, he's now the guy who is singled out by hockey fans who bemoan that level of physicality. And yeah, he toes the line of legality for sure. And he definitely stepped over it when he broke a Penguins player's jaw in the semifinals. But, you know, it's a generational divide, right? Like, I grew up watching the Patrick Division. I grew up watching a different brand of hockey. I completely understand the attention given to players like Wilson and the injurious nature of their games. So I get that. But I just think that sometimes the overcorrection from fans towards a player that plays that rough and that physical can be too much and unfortunate. As far as the Rick Westhead stuff goes, that stuff's really interesting. I mean, you had an email that was detailed in this report from Mike Murphy, one NHL executive, to Colin Campbell, who was a very highly ranking NHL executive back in 2007, in which Mike Murphy said it'd be better for the league if we called fewer major penalties on elbowings, because major penalties get the media's attention more than minor penalties does. And you just are, could you imagine if this was the NFL and like there was a letter between NFL executives saying we have to stop calling so many personal fouls because people notice them more, you know, despite the fact that they're completely warranted and they're plays that are causing concussions and potentially, you know, debilitating dementia-laden diseases later on in life. I mean, that's sort of where we're at with the level of embarrassment right now at the NHL with these reports that are coming out and this testimony that was being reported by TSN. And I don't know if there's necessarily a smoking gun there that's going to cost them a lawsuit, but I know for a fact that it is a huge embarrassment to the league to see how they've handled this stuff in the past publicly and how they continue, in Gary Bettman's case, to deny the existence of CTE now.
Greg Wyshynski, if he weren't a hockey writer for ESPN, he could be a game show host. I'm certain of that.
Oh, my Greg. God. I have the hair for it right now, at least.
Thank you for mucking it up in the crease with us, Greg.
Anytime, boys. Thanks.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
All right, we are leaving you after ball lists this week, but we will be after ball rific next week. Is that a promise, Stefan?
Promise.
It's a guarantee.
After ball full.
Ball full. that is our show for today. And why am I even apologizing? Was I apologizing?
A little bit.
We had a really good, strong segment this week. It's a great show. Our producer is Patrick Fort. He did a great job producing this episode, I thought. To listen to past shows, which have all been great, and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. And don't forget the 5 stars. Give us a good review on iTunes.
There was a show like in 2014 that I think we mailed it in.
Yeah, but so long ago. I think that's been memory hold. Don't mention that in the review. For Stefan Fatsis, I'm Josh Levine. Remember Zelmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.